listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rositi, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the well-being of our total health environment, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of food, water, air, and earth, and the ecological stability and balance of our habitat planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different experts, thought leaders, scientists, advocates, activists, filmmakers, authors, doctors, and more about all of the different facets of what's going on in our world that impacts our well-being, our families' well-being, and future generations of humans and all species here on planet Earth. The show has been ongoing since February of 2011. We're now in the second half of our seventh year, and it's a pleasure to be here and talking with the great guests that come on to this show to share their outstanding work. On today's show, I am delighted and honored to have with us someone who is an amazing organizer and activist on behalf of a whole range of peace and justice movements, and her signature work in recent years has been with the climate and environmental movement. My guest today is Leslie Kagan. She's currently the coordinator of the People's Climate Movement in New York and serves on the National People's Climate Movement Leadership Body. She has done so much, a whole range of different kinds of organizing and work, mobilization, and coalition building in this and other important interrelated spaces. Most relevant to her conversation today is that she was actually the co-coordinator of the September 21st, 2014 People's Climate March, in which, you know, I was very happy to walk in that march, as were many friends, colleagues, allies. It brought 400,000 people into the streets of New York demanding action on the global climate crisis. And, you know, honestly, I think it's probably the number one signature climate event of our time. And it was exhilarating and incredible to participate in. But we, you know, have a lot more work to do as more and more people are coming to realize over the last year, with a whole host of different climate crisis-related environmental events battering people all over this country and all over the world. We'll be talking with Leslie Kagan today about all of this, as well as an upcoming action participation opportunity coming up very shortly that people can participate in. So it's my honor to welcome to Connect the Dots, Leslie Kagan.
Hi, and I hope everyone's doing well today. It's a beautiful day here in New York, and I hope people are gearing up for what promises to be a great weekend here in the city around the fifth anniversary of when Superstorm Sandy hit the city and literally wiped things out in town here.
Yeah, that was quite an event. Our listenership, you know, the studio and I are based in New York. Our listenership is, you know, really national and global. I certainly recall Superstorm Sandy and its extensive aftermath quite well. You know, the city was really shut down. The subway was flooded and non-functional. Many roads were, you know, under many, many feet of water. I did some reporting about that on Alternate at the time that it was occurring. Can you, you know, give listeners who are not familiar with that, and now we've had so many this past year, there's so many different climatological events hitting different places. But this was really the first one that drew our attention to the fact that, you know, the second one after Katrina, and, of course, we also had the Fukushima events, multiple events. But can you really orient any listeners who may not be from this region listening to the show and might be unfamiliar with Superstorm Sandy and what happened there?
Sure, sure. And let me just start by saying that, of course, the climate, the severe weather and the severe climate activity that Superstorm Sandy was a part of, was one manifestation of, it's happening all over the world. I mean, it's happening all over the country. It's happening all over the world. So, you know, as a New Yorker, obviously, I'm obsessed with what goes on in New York City. But, you know, right now, you know, certainly in these last few months, there have been major activities, you know, extreme weather activities, in part, not completely or not only caused by climate change, but certainly made a very, very much worse because of climate change throughout the Caribbean, in India and Pakistan and Nepal, Bangladesh, that whole area hit terribly this summer by, you know, monsoons, which, of course, they always have monsoons in that part of the world, but much more severe monsoons. 1,300 people, at least 1,300 people died as a result of those. And, of course, the fires out west and the particularly horrific fires in California that have been raging and killing people, destroying property, businesses, et cetera, but mostly killing people. I mean, it's so all of this is part of the reality of climate change, which I'm sure your listeners, you know a great deal about. In New York, 5 years ago, this coming weekend, and actually it's on October 29th, the storm, Superstorm Sandy, which had begun in the Caribbean and, you know, did a whole bunch of damage in the Caribbean and then came up kind of along the coastline of the East Coast of the United States and then eventually hit in the, not only New York City, but the greater metropolitan area in New Jersey, Long Island, some parts of Connecticut, you know, were hit very, very hard. And the city was, had never experienced anything like this. I mean, none of the region had ever experienced anything like this, where the floodwaters literally knocked out the electric grid so that something like 2 million customers lost electricity. Now, some came on, you know, within 24 hours, but many places, you know, it took much longer for them to get electricity. Something like at least 44 people were killed in New York City. The numbers are higher for the whole region. Subway lines, in fact, they're still dealing with subway lines with fixing up and, you know, improving since the damage caused by Sandy 5 years ago, a number of the subway lines in New York City, major flooding in the tunnels. Actually, there's also an iconic photograph that some of you all might have seen where basically from 34th Street, which is about, you know, a third of the way up the island of Manhattan to the very lower tip of Manhattan, went completely dark because the electric grid was completely knocked out. That includes, you know, literally a few million people in that area alone, let alone Brooklyn and the, you know, parts of Queens, Staten Island, the Rockaways, Sunset Park, I mean, and the Lower East Side, many, many neighborhoods in New York City were, you know, dealt a very severe blow. Houses completely devastated, but also other important institutions in communities, you know, healthcare clinics, grocery stores, libraries, schools, the public transportation, all knocked out, and some still in the rebuilding process now. There's still people who have not gotten back to their homes 5 years later. So it was a major storm, the likes of which New York City had certainly never seen. But again, you know, it's not the only major storm that's happened. And in fact, what's happened in the last 5 years is that the climate crisis has just gotten worse and worse and worse, the global climate crisis. And we are deeply concerned that our elected leadership on every level of government has not really stepped up to do enough, both to deal with recovery and resiliency issues for future storms, but also to really begin to tackle the contributions that, it's a funny word to use, but the contributions that our city and state make to the climate crisis by the incredibly large carbon footprint that we have.
Well, you know, obviously,
you know, no one is happy with the stance of the present administration, which is a denialist, pro-fossil fuel stance that will only accelerate climate change. You know, the upside is hopefully that more people are, you know, waking up to the problem, the severity of the problem, and kind of just, rather than just getting along with, well, you know, there's a debate about it. Fewer people, more people understand, you know, that it's not really a debate. It's a denialist, corporate-sponsored PR campaign on one side, and, you know, all the world's scientists in the field of climatology on the other side. So that's not really a scientific debate. Now we're getting right. evidence of it. Do you think that people are becoming more aware, more activated, you know, as a result of, you know, these tragedies, really?
Right. You know, it's, to tell you honestly, I'm a little confused about the state of public consciousness and awareness this issue. I think, you know, clearly when people are in the midst of, or, you know, right in the immediate aftermath of their own local climate crisis, they kind of shake their heads and say, oh, my God, maybe this climate problem is real and we need to do something. But then, you know, life in many places begins to settle back to normal, although I should say, as a footnote to that, there's plenty of places like in Puerto Rico right now where life is far from back to normal, and it's going to take a long, long time. Oh, yeah, and even in New Orleans, life is far from normal again since Katrina hit. Over 12 years ago now. But people go back to their lives, the details of their lives. And in some ways, I think for a lot of people, the climate crisis, because it's not something you personally experience every single day, is a little bit of, it's still a little bit of an abstraction, and therefore hard to kind of wrap their heads around and become active on. So our job, I think, as a climate movement, as a movement of people, which has been growing, I'm not saying no one's tuned in or active on it, there are plenty of people who are, but our job is to, in part, find a way without terrorizing people, you know, without making them so scared that they're paralyzed, but to keep people aware and awake on the dangers and the reality of the climate crisis, the dangers of it, that not only is it not going away, unless there is very urgently needed and bold and big steps taken, it's going to get a lot worse very quickly. And it's a challenge. I mean, it is an organizing challenge to take, quite honestly.
How long have you been involved with the climate movement?
Well, for many years, you know, I went to various and sundry climate activities. I mean, I sort of was aware of, well, first, you know, for many, many years ago, I went to what we used to call environmental activities, which obviously a whole lot of those concerns are very directly tied to the climate crisis. And I, you know, over the years I did some work on some events and activities, but it was not a major focus of my organizing and activism life. But then several years ago, well, really after Sandy, I started thinking more about it. Again, having, you know, experienced the, you know, what that climate crisis brought to New York City. You know, I got more engaged and started poking around the movement a little more. And then it was really about, I guess about 3.5 years ago now, when I got directly involved in the organizing for the People's Climate March in September of 2014. And then since then, that has been, the climate work has been my major and primary focus of my organizing. So, you know, like with many issues, I think part of our task is to help people see, you know, how this work is connected to other issues that they are already involved in and engaged with, and not to drop their other work, but to expand the scope of their activism to include, to directly include, you know, work around the climate crisis.
What, tell our listeners a little bit more about the upcoming event, you know, just the logistics, how they could be involved, and then, you know, what the purpose of it is and what you're hoping to accomplish through it?
Sure. You know, actually, let me start with that, with the purpose of it, why we're doing it. And because that maybe can inspire not only those in the greater New York area to come out this weekend and to join us on this march, but also people in other parts of the country to think about how you might translate, you know, use what we're doing here in New York City as hopefully an inspiration to do some of the same kind of work in your neck of the woods. But this weekend, as I said, is the 5th anniversary when Sandy hit New York. So we, first a small group, but it's grown and grown and grown. We're thinking that it would be a good opportunity because, you know, sometimes people and certainly the media, we knew would be focusing on the 5th anniversary. You know, those anniversaries are kind of, you know, marked by some more public attention. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to not only remember and honor the people, the families that were hit so hard and suffered so much loss, and in some cases are still dealing with the aftermath of the storm, to honor those people, those communities, but to also say to our elected officials, particularly, you know, a special emphasis on the city and state level, but also to some degree on the national level, that we, you know, we have to move beyond nice speeches about climate. And really, it's time for a very bold, big, sweeping, deep, whatever word you want to use, policy changes related to the ways New York City and New York State contribute to the climate crisis, and also policy changes related to protecting people in our communities to the degree we can from other, you know, devastating impacts of the climate crisis. So we have, you know, New York City and New York State both have a mayor and a governor who have, you know, given lots of good speeches about climate. They seem to get it, that there is really a climate crisis. And they both have done some things. They made some policy changes, which is good. I don't want to take that away from them. But it's not enough. It's not nearly enough. So we are using this occasion to not only mark an anniversary, but also project through a series of demands that we're raising, the need for and the particular issues that we know can be acted on, to project those as demands on our mayor and our governor, and also on one of our United States senators, who happens to be Chuck Schumer, who is obviously in a very important position, a difficult position, but an important position in Washington as the, you know, the top-ranking Democrat in the Senate. Obviously, you know, we're not expecting a lot of positive stuff to come out of Washington these days, and that means that we, you know, we believe that it's all the more reason to focus on the city and state level where there is some possibility of actually securing some real victories. So we have very specific demands, both at the state and city level, but also on the federal level, too, that we're marching for. And so it's both a remembrance and a call to action. We're actually doing our demonstration on Saturday, which is the day before the storm hit, because many of the communities that were hard hit by Sandy are doing very, you know, local neighborhood activities on that day itself. We wanted to honor and respect that, you know, those events.
Back in the when Superstorm Sandy was happening, there was kind of, you know, promises or discussion of building a wall around Lower Manhattan where all the water came flooding in. And, you know, I haven't seen, I mean, now we have these other walls to keep immigrants in, to keep the, you know, horrible weather systems of climate change out. You know, it seems like a very primitive level of thinking that a wall is going to, you know, exclude something that is more occurring through large-scale systemic reasons. But as far as I'm aware, and maybe I'm not aware, but I haven't even heard anything about a wall. Is that just the kind of thing that people say, you know, in the midst of something to kind of, you know, public officials say that to give people reassurance, and it's not really realistic. It's never going to happen. Do you think it's a good idea?
I'm not an engineer or a scientist or I don't know all the mechanics of what it would take to build something that could protect storm surges. That's basically what it's about. It's protecting against the surges that come, with these big storms, the extraordinary waves and hits. By the way, people should remember that when these storm surges come, they are not only are they ferocious because of the wind. They usually, it's the wind that's bringing them onto the land and making them even more dangerous, because it's not just water, it's water and wind in that combination, especially those high winds that you get at hurricane speeds. It's phenomenally powerful. But it's also salt water. And salt water is, as we know, completely corrosive. I mean, it leads to a lot of problems. Yes, I do know that there has been an ongoing discussion, the proposals that have been looked at quite seriously to build. My understanding, it wouldn't be a permanent wall. It would be something that would be embedded, in the water in some way that then would rise up. Brought up when a storm was coming. So it wouldn't be like a permanent feature.
I
think they call it the big U or something like that. It'd be like a U that would go, a U shape that would go around the southern end of Manhattan. I think that there's some scientific evidence that this, if done right, it could help protect against some storm surge. And there are other models of things like this, I believe, in other parts of the world. So it's not like a totally crazy idea. It is extremely expensive. I forget now what the cost is, but, it's billions of dollars. And what it doesn't do is that particular project doesn't really help to places like the Far Rockaways or Staten Island or Sunset Park or Red Hook, other neighborhoods in New York City that were also extremely hard hit by Sandy. And one problem is that there has not been the same kind of resources poured into even the development and research aspect of this work at this point for that would provide that kind of mitigation against, horrendous storms to the neighborhoods around the city. And the truth is that when you look at a map of New York City, most of the neighborhoods that were hardest hit by Sandy also happened to be places that had been historically under-resourced and more people of color, more poor people, or low-income people, live in those neighborhoods. So those neighborhoods need even greater attention. So a lot of the activist groups in those neighborhoods are calling for, a new look, for instance, at how development and the creation of housing and waterfront programs and all that is happening. The city, like many other places, the developers, the contractors, the buildings people are just going crazy in New York. There's so much large-scale development that obviously is very profitable for somebody, but doesn't really serve the needs of these, especially waterfront communities. So we're calling for a whole, recalibrating of those kinds of development projects. No one is opposed to development. It just has to be done in a way that makes sense and actually serves the needs of communities. And there are other things that we know need to be done. I've noticed that what we've just been talking about are really about resilience to new storms that come. And we don't have a crystal ball, but most likely there will be future storms. So it does make sense to put some serious effort into these resilience projects. At the same time, though, we're also raising a whole host of demand.
Can I just ask a question before we move off the development topic? Which is obviously very important, because that is, kind of avoidance of the actual situation we're going to be in if you just keep adding to it with development, build on the waterfront, et cetera. It must be noted that our current president and his family are in the real estate development business, and their stance is ostensibly you know, maybe they're just saying this for expedience, or it may be true, is one of climate denial. You know, are they actually, not only through the federal policies, but are they actually worsening the problem through ongoing plans for major development?
You know, I don't know if the Trump businesses, I don't keep track of the Trump business decisions, thankfully. And so I don't know if they are directly involved in projects that have to do with waterfront or, you know, coastal waterfront development. I just don't have the answer to that. I don't know.
Well, that's fair.
But certainly on the policy level, you know, they, you know, if you look at this kind of big picture, they certainly have never, I've never heard of them raising a voice against a development project because, you know, it could lead to increased, you know, problems should there be, or when there will be another storm coming down the road, or a whole host of other problems that come along with some of this development.
Right, exactly. Well, what are, if any, the initiatives that are current, have been taken or are under consideration within the city or state, you know, that would potentially help provide some relief or at least forestall worsening of these climate symptoms?
Right. Well, again, like I said earlier in the show here, that the New York City and New York State, especially New York City, makes a major contribution to the global climate crisis. It is, and that the biggest emissions, the biggest carbon emissions in New York City come from what the shorthand is big buildings. Well, they are big buildings. Some of the, something like 70% of carbon emissions in New York City come from buildings of 25,000 square feet or more, of which there are many in New York City, as I'm sure your listenership knows. So for instance, we have been, there's been an ongoing campaign in the city here to try to we've both been focusing on the mayor and the city council to pass legislation that would mandate, not make it as a suggestion, but actually mandate the owners of those large buildings to retrofit the buildings to make sure that they are energy efficient. I'm sorry, I don't have all the figures at the tip of my tongue here, but it would be, you know, obviously this kind of major project of, you know, making sure that these buildings are all energy efficient would unfold over several years. It's not going to happen overnight. All the more reason why it has to start immediately. But, you know, it would be done on a timeline that would allow the work to be done thoroughly, that would dramatically reduce the carbon emissions in New York City, and would open up at the same time literally thousands of new jobs for the people doing that work, and that we all, of course, would demand, are demanding that not only that process begin now, but that those jobs, that there be a commitment that those jobs, the good union jobs that people are trained for, you know, have basic decent jobs standards attached to it, working standards, and that also that there be a calculation made so that especially on buildings that are owned by the city, that savings, because over time there will be significant energy savings, cost savings, you know, once those buildings are retrofitted and do become more energy efficient, that there'd be a program put into place that those savings go back into the most historically underserved neighborhoods of the city. So in other words, what we're talking about is a whole package that is doing the climate work through the lens of economic and social justice, and weaving that all together. The mayor has put forth his own proposal around some of this, but you know, if you just look at it, you think, oh, this is pretty good. The problem is, it's not on a bold enough or fast enough timeline. It needs to be much more aggressive if we're going to come even close to meeting the standards set by the Paris Accords. you know, the mayor had said, we're in on Paris, right? When Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords agreements. And the mayor was one of many mayors, not only here in New York, but around the country, who said, no, we're in. We're not pulling out. Well, at the rate that his proposal, if his proposal was put into law and put into place, we would come close to meeting the goal set by the Paris Agreement. It's just not a bold enough plan that he has. So we're saying, that's great. You know, good beginning. Now here's what you really have to do. And similarly with the governor, the governor has taken some steps, you know, around the state. But what we're saying is that there needs to be, and in fact, it's a statewide campaign that includes, you know, some very specific legislative initiatives that, you know, we would like to see passed, become law in the state, that are would put New York State on a fast track to moving completely 100% off of fossil fuels and 100% into renewable energies. And again, though, if we're going to do that on a time frame that comes close to what the Paris Agreement said, then the bold steps need to begin now. So we're saying to our elected officials, it's time to move beyond the nice speeches. The nice speeches are great, but, you know, they're not enough. We need the really sweeping policy changes, and we need you to step up and not be shy about, you know, using the power of their offices to push forward on these much more, much larger and bolder initiatives, and on a fast timeline.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense. How actively, you know, how is the organizing going? How many people are you expecting? And if people want to participate, where do they go online, or where do they show up?
Yeah, it's always hard to know, you know, exactly what the turnout's going to be, although the weather should be good, so that helps. We're not talking on the scale of the march 3 years ago in New York City. I mean, there's not going to be hundreds of thousands of people here. But there will be thousands of people marching from literally every part of the city. There's something like, I believe it's now 140 groups around New York City that have signed on to this effort, that are part of the coalition, and helping to get word out and, you know, build energy. I mean, to be honest, I'm not going to play games with people. Some groups are doing more work than others. You know, some just, you know, literally put their name on the list, and others are doing an all-out push with their membership. We're also completely aware that, certainly here in New York City, I think this is true in many parts of the country, these last months since Trump took office, people have been out at demonstrations and in the streets, you know, every weekend just about. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been, you know, many, many demonstrations on many issues, understandably, and it's all important, and we don't want to discourage anybody from doing that. At the same time, we're aware that it takes a toll. So not as many people may come to X demonstration or Y demonstration as, you know, might have a few years ago, just because they're tired. And how many, you know, how many times can you hit the streets in a month? So we are, but nonetheless, we are expecting, you know, good turnout and a very energetic and representational turnout. In other words, we had set our goals not only, you know, to turn out as many people as we could, but also to hopefully get a turnout that looks like New York City. That when you look at the crowd, it will feel like New York City. It feels in the richness of its diversity and the many communities and different people. And that, I think, we are on the path to achieving. That's really a good cross-section of New Yorkers. There'll be a tremendous amount of artwork and creativity that's gone into, you know, what the day will look like. So and just, you know, marching over the bridge is always, it's always a powerful thing to do at the Brooklyn Bridge, and which is what we'll be doing. And so I think all in all, we're set up for a very strong, powerful day, and the message will get out.
So if people are interested, where do they go online? And then we'll talk about where they go in person, like if you're interested in marching, if you're in the area.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's great. Yeah, online it's really easy. We have a website, and in case you didn't think of it yourself, it's sandy5.org. It's a very simple, obvious kind of website URL, sandy5.org. We have a lot of information on there, the spelling out of the demands that we're raising, the list of 170 organizations that have signed on, a whole section on social media and what folks can do, you know, sample tweets and emails and Facebook postings, an active Facebook page as well, and of course the details of the plans for the day. So it's all on the website. Again, it's sandy5.org. Five the number, not spelled out. sandy5.org. And we are doing our best, you know, to keep it as up to date as we can, so the most current information is posted there. And there's a way to sign up there for you to get more information, more updates, including, I'm not sure how long we'll keep the site going after the demonstration, but it will be up and running for a while, so we can direct people or, you know, inform people about other ways that they can be involved in the ongoing work of this movement, which, of course, again, is a critical component of any mobilization, is to get people, you know, more engaged in the ongoing work. So that's the easiest way. Virtually, you know, online to find us and to get connected. In person, if you're in New York, or even, you know, if you're not in New York, those of you listening to the show now, but know people who are in New York, by the way, you know, you might encourage them to go to the website and think about coming to the demonstration too. Especially if you would come if you were in New York, but you can't because you're physically not here, maybe you could send a representative, you know, encourage some friends or family, people you know in New York City to head on out on Saturday morning. So we'll, the demonstration, our activities are Saturday morning. This is Saturday, the 28th of October, and we will be assembling in Brooklyn at Cadman Plaza Park. It's a lot of New Yorkers know where it is. It's very easy to get to. It's right near the Brooklyn end of the Brooklyn Bridge. But it's on anybody can Google it. It's on you know, Google Maps. It's really easy to find. Cadman Plaza Park. And we'll be assembling there at 11 a.m. on Saturday morning. Starting at about 11:30 or so, we will have a rally that will go for about an hour. And the speakers are predominantly, overwhelmingly, people who survived Sandy, some are from Staten Island, someone from the Rockaways, someone from Red Hook, someone from the Lower East Side. In other words, a number of the neighborhoods hardest hit by Sandy will speak about their experience, what happened, what's still going on in terms of the, you know, full recovery from Sandy, and therefore why they're marching, why they're part of this movement, and you know, what demands that they are. You know, each person will say something about one or more of the demands as well. We'll also have, you know, some music and a poet and, you know, a few other speakers, including somebody who will specifically give a more in-depth presentation of our demands, so that it's really clear to everybody who's there, and including hopefully the media that shows up. Then at 12:30, we line up and begin to march over the Brooklyn Bridge. Like I said, it should be a beautiful day, so it'll be a very nice. It's, you know, it's not a short walk, but it's certainly doable. Many people do it every day, and we're trying to make the point that we're, you know, connecting the boroughs of the city together. Unfortunately, we can't do all five boroughs, but at least we can do those two. When we get off the Brooklyn Bridge in the Manhattan side, we will take a route or sort of make a U-turn, go down through some side streets, and end up at a public housing. It's called NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority, NYCHA Housing here in the city. That was hard hit by Sandy. It's right next to the Brooklyn Bridge, and they are still dealing with recovery issues there. Wow. And we're being welcomed there by the Tenants Association, the people who live there and are struggling with these issues. And we'll have a closing activity there that will include more of a party and a collective, a communal art project that we're going to ask people to participate in. We're going to paint the ball field there, again, all in cooperation and coordination with the Tenants Association there at the housing facility. So it's going to be a very powerful day. We also know that it's a long day. And for a lot of reasons, any number of reasons, some people are not going to be able to do the whole march. So if anybody wants to come just at the beginning to the rally at Cadman Plaza at 11 a.m., they are more than welcome to. If anybody wants to go just to the closing activity at Smith Houses in Manhattan beginning at 2 p.m., that'll probably go from 2 to 4, they are more than welcome to. If somebody just wants to join us at the bridge and do the bridge part, that's fine. We obviously would love it for people to do the whole day with us, but if you can only do part of the day, you're more than welcome. We know we have a good plan for the day. We hope to have a lot of folks, whether they do the whole thing or parts of it. I tell you, honestly, when people do parts of it, it's harder to get a total count of the day, but we don't really care so much as, giving people the opportunity to engage in whatever way they can. That's the most important element of the day, is opening up the engagement for people.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess the thing that's encouraging in what you're describing as well is the fact that people have an opportunity to act on a local community level, if they're, I guess, fortunate enough to be in states where, the leadership are not climate deniers. That still doesn't mean that, that leadership is taking sufficient timely action.
Right.
As you describe, but at least, we're not dealing, on the state or regional level, at least in New York, and there are many other areas like this as well, we're not dealing with, someone who is just an unqualified fossil fuel promoter, no matter what the impacts, So,
right.
So that's
right.
Something,
the reality of who our elected officials are in New York City and New York State does give us some reason to be hopeful that we can actually secure these policy changes that we're demanding at this point. But let me just say two things. One, even in the best of circumstances, and we feel like that politically anyway, we're in pretty good circumstances. Try and win these battles. None of it comes easy. There are big, certainly in New York City and actually throughout New York State now, there are very powerful forces. They may not be climate deniers, but they are the building industry and landlords and the fossil fuel industry. Yeah, there are very powerful forces that don't agree with the platform that we're putting forth, and put their own pressures on elected officials. So even in these circumstances, we have to work very hard. I would also say, though, that even if you live in a state where the top leadership, maybe the governor or people at the state level or even your local mayor, whatever, are more climate deniers, fall more in that camp, I still would encourage folks to think about ways that you might, raise a demand locally and begin, because it's a way to even if you don't in the end or very quickly win the specific demand that you may be raising, it's a way to organize a campaign to change local policy can be a very powerful organizing tool, a way to help people see that this issue does boil down to the reality on the ground where they live. And that's critically important. I think there's almost always some vehicle, some way for people at the local level to figure out how to do a campaign related to the climate, the global climate process challenge, and to have it be meaningful. easy is another thing, but meaningful, I think, is within our reach.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask a question, because, you know, you have been doing successful organizing for years. You have, you know, committed to this specific issue out of a host of interrelated issues that you have promoted over time. Two questions. One, what do you think, in talking to people, that the most persuasive things that, that any of us could say to inspire people to really get involved would be? You know, because, I mean, for example, I'm mostly talking to people who are not climate deniers. They're aware of the problem. They're kind of, they're going, oh, yes, something must be done. But then, you know, just like some of our well-meaning elected officials whom you've mentioned, you know, then there are compromises. For the average person, the compromise is, you know, maybe I go to one or two marches, but mostly I don't get involved. I wouldn't want to bring it up and have a discussion with somebody that may, you know, not be in agreement. In other words, we admit that it's happening, but that doesn't necessarily translate into we do something about it. What do you think is most successful
in those
conversations?
Well, I think that's always a challenge that organizers face in, you know, in a host of issues, getting people to see that the point you're making is well taken, getting them to actually then take a step and be engaged in it is, you know, that's another layer of engagement. But it's always a challenge to organizers face. I think in this one, as I said earlier, it's a bigger challenge in a lot of ways, in that it is a you know, sometimes it feels a little bit like an abstraction, climate change. It feels like a little distant and not real, and you know, for a lot of ways, it doesn't feel totally real in people's day-to-day lives. So I don't have a formula. I don't have a, yes, this is how we're going to do it kind of approach to this. I do think that it's, you know, in each situation, we've got to look at the reality, what's on the ground, what's going on, what will resonate for people. I do think, though, that part of what we need to do here is find a way to raise, almost, it's almost like the moral and ethical issues here about the role that we as human beings have to play in preserving this planet for future generations. I don't mean to get too abstract here, but there is a serious question about what the planet will look like in 10 years, in 20 years, in 50 years, in 100 years. And while none of us will be alive in 100 years, you know, I hope that we are concerned about future generations. And I think that we do have to, that we shouldn't be so cynical as to think that people aren't moved by ethical arguments. You know, I think that they are sometimes or often. You know, I think we have to make those points as well. You know, and I don't know. You know, I can't give you right now a shorthand version of that, but there are ways to frame that. And again, to look at, you know, I think each time one of these major weather problems happen, you know, be it Harvey or Irma or Maria, to say, well, what was that about? Yes, the storms happen all the time, but why so severe? And, you know, and open up that discussion, use it as what we call a teachable moment, right? Look, that this has happened, it could happen again. You know, hurricanes usually form in the Atlantic, but there are other kind of weather phenomena. You know, monsoons don't happen here. They happen in Asia. And why are those monsoons so much worse, right? Why are these wildfires happening with such severity and such intensity? And use any and all of those as a teachable moment, and then look to, well, what is our city or county or state doing, both in terms of how it's contributing to the climate crisis by its carbon footprint, and what can we do to move away from it, to move toward 100% renewables? The truth of the matter is, the technology is there. Right. The science is there. The technology is there. It is possible to move off of fossil fuels and into a new era of energy resources. So, you know, the energy that we use, it could come from renewable sources. And there are now several that are completely viable economically and scientifically, et cetera. It's just the political will has to be shifted.
Well, you know, it's a kind of chicken-egg problem because one of the reasons, you know, I mean, when you say political will, I guess there are two groups participating, or, you know, minimum of two groups, but just in very large stroke ways, participating in the political will. On the one hand, we have the public, citizens, and
right.
some of them may be coming from different places and have different perspectives. On the other hand, the political will is expressed by elected officials and appointed officials. You know, is frequently corralled, if not universally corralled, with certain notable exceptions, into doing the bidding of the very industries that profit from perpetuating the problem.
Right.
So, you know, the question then becomes, I mean, and let's just discuss it frankly for a minute or two here, you know, how does our actions like marches, our initiatives like you know, asking and making demands for certain things, how effective are they? You know, what is the degree of their effectiveness and what are the best leverage points when the target of the action will always be elected officials who, on the other hand, are going, I have to shake hands with this one and that one and that industry and Wall Street in order to finance my next run for office.
Right. Well, clearly, I mean, from my point of view, it's clear. Unfortunately, not everybody sees the same clarity. These issues are very much immersed. You know, the power of money in our government, both in the electoral process, but then once people are in office, and the power of, you know, well-heeled lobbyists, and the moneyed interests they represent, the power of the fossil fuel industry, which is a major, major, not only U.S. industry, but globally, you know, major force to contend with. And so these are, we're up against a lot. So we just have to be smart and creative and not shy about what we're calling for and the ways that we're calling for it. We have to engage more people. We have to use all the tools and techniques that we have available in terms of the range of protests, the kinds of educational work we do, the media work, social media, you know, everything. And we have to use every tool we have available to help educate people, help generate more activism, and find ways to increase and deepen the pressure on policymakers. You know, there have been other moments in human history when things seemed impossible to change, and yet somehow they changed. So, you know, this struggle, I believe, is, you know, one of those major, major struggles that we simply cannot walk away from. Even if at times it feels like we're hitting our head against a wall, we cannot walk away from it. We have a moral responsibility to do whatever it is we can. And I'm not saying everybody will be engaged at the same level of activism, but if everybody was engaged in the level and in the way that they felt comfortable with, that would add up to a whole lot of creative, powerful energy.
Well, that is very true. I have to say as well that, you know, and I don't know, this may just be my own life priorities, but the way I look at it is, you know, having been with people in the final months or weeks, days, hours of their lives, you know, I always just think, well, yeah, I want to do this for the sake of the places on earth I love. I want to do it for the people I care about who may be going on further than myself and then those, you know, who may have as their descendants. I want to do it for the breeds of plant and vegetable and animal that, you know, have been so kind and loving and generous and supported my life in various ways. But ultimately also, I just feel like, you know, I'm doing it for myself because I don't know how I could stand back and look at my life and say, oh, you know, I made that beautiful carpet over there, or I was part of selling, you know, 200 cars, or, right. I led a class of adorable kindergartners, but I did nothing to secure their future. That's what I personally do, but I guess each of us has to find our own, where that place is, that, you know, right. where that matters.
Right.
Because
exactly.
I think on some level, a lot of people are kind of going to a place where, they're kind of kidding themselves that it doesn't matter. You know, if I can't do anything, then I'm better off just doing what I am already doing right now, which is, leading exercise classes. And all of these things might be really good things to do, you know,
right.
We're just living in such a turnkey time.
I don't want to, if I can just interrupt, I don't want to suggest any kind of hierarchy of activism or engagement. Whatever mm-hmm. people can do is what they should do.
Right.
You know, that it's as simple as that. For me, it's as simple as that. And once you're engaged, then, you know, if it makes sense to you to stay at that level of engagement, that's what you should do. If you think you can do more, then do more. You know, it doesn't matter. It's not like one size fits all. Everybody has to find
right.
what works for them and where they feel they are making a contribution, and it's possible for them to still lead their lives. I want to be very clear.
We're going to have to come to the end of the show here. So I just want to, before we go out, thank you. I want to tell people that you can go once again to Sandy5, the number 5.org. It's one of the easiest, most easy to find web URLs I've ever seen. It provides all the information about the 5th anniversary of the Superstorm Sandy event, which is being commemorated through a terrific march taking place in Brooklyn and Manhattan this Saturday, October 28th, 11 a.m., and organized by our wonderful guest, Leslie Kagan, who's been with us for the last hour on the show. Folks, you can go there and sign up. You can show up and march at any point along the march. You can share this Connect the Dots program with your friends on, you know, social media, invite other people, tell other people about it. You can, invite them to listen to the show and hear the reasons and all about this terrific march and the tremendous need for it. Thank you so much, Leslie Kagan, for being with us
sure.
on today's show. Yeah, it's
Thank
been a great
you.
Conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's great talking to you all. Take care.
Yeah. All right. And thank you,
Bye-bye.
Listeners, for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Just want to apologize because I've been kind of caught up and busy and we've been doing repeats for the last several weeks. But we are back and coming to you with a whole series of upcoming shows. So keep staying tuned and keep, you know, head up, keep marching forward, standing tall with all our relations. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be healthy in the coming weeks.